In 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Our local writing community is thriving. With your first draft in NaNoWriMo complete, there's a lot more to learn about getting your story into the hands of readers. Find Reading Writers Forum on Facebook to connect. And of course, this holiday season, we want to give a big shout out to our troops for the opportunity they've given us to create freely. So this Christmas, we give a big salute to our troops.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Slavery existed. Slavery is a barbaric practice. It's a stain on the founding. It's kind of the central stain. You know, on the one hand, they didn't get rid of slavery in 1776. But what's amazing is that a bunch of people, many of whom owned slaves, declared that all men are created equal. That is, they put the principle down in the Declaration of Independence. And then American history is a playing out of those principles.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. We talk in depth with Dr. Spaulding today about what citizens should learn about America and civics education across the country. Dr. Spaulding, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Talking today about a piece you wrote in the Washington Examiner, what should citizens learn about America and civics education in general? Why is civics education important?
Well, that's actually a great way to start the conversation. And the title of the piece kind of actually alludes to the problem itself, which is the question here is there a certain type of education that is above and beyond, say, technical education or history simply or literature, but a certain type of education that is appropriate for citizens? Traditionally, we have called this, referred to this as civic education. There's a type of education that a citizen, especially in a free country, in an American country in particular, the American Constitutional Republic, citizens ought to know certain things about their country, about how it works, about the rule of law, the Constitution, rights, human equality. And that's crucial for being a good citizen, for being a good citizen in a republic. And a component of that is that you need to know how the history of the American regime began and played those principles out and what their status is today. So there's actually a much broader question here in terms of why is this type of education important, say, in the United States, a free republic in which we self-govern, as opposed, say, a monarchy in the past or a closed society or in China. Right here, it's actually important for self-governing citizens to be educated about the source of their rights and ability to govern themselves under the rule of law. That's actually a component of citizenship, which has to be taught in the context of education in order to continue that understanding of citizenship.
So how would you describe the overall state of civics education in our country today, and why are we kind of having this ongoing debate over the topic?
Well, it partially goes back to the very definition I've given, which is there actually is great disagreement about that. So civics education today is in bad shape. Polling suggests this, both in terms of knowledge of history, but also knowledge of the workings of the American political process, if you will. And that's been getting worse over time. And I can come back to kind of a couple of phases about why it's been getting worse. But the general thing to understand is that There are large segments of the, especially the American Academy, when many of these ideas come out of the universities and are kind of bleeding into debates about education. But this kind of idea of education coming from the academy into, shall we call it, the education bureaucracy that really dominates education, especially the K-12 level, there's a sense that we ought not to teach civic education as a knowledge, as an amount as something where you're transferring information into the minds of these students, because that's biased, but it's also grounded in the various historical problems, the existence of slavery being one of the most prominent, but also we should do other things with them. So, for instance, the two things I think have especially fed the decline of civic education. You know, one is in previous decades, in the later 20th century, which was a tendency to look at civics, and we don't want to look at civics as knowledge, that is, you should know about American history or how government works or sources of your rights, but as an activity.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding with us, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. Hillsdale has entered the conversation, continued the conversation with something called the 1776 curriculum. We've discussed it on the show previously. And part of your essay at the Examiner responds to some of the attacks on the curriculum. Some say it whitewashes or rewrites or omits parts of history. What do critics get wrong about 1776 and what Hillsdale does?
Well, I mean, part of it goes back to this conversation we just had, which is there's this debate over civics itself. And what is really at issue here is Hillsdale's 1776 curriculum is actually itself not at all radical. It's not at all controversial. It's actually what a good civics education ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the civics debate, and especially the American educational debate, driven by a lot of the kind of the education bureaucrats and the academy, meaning the academia, has moved away from that. And so as a result, they're highly critical of a more traditional approach. But it's kind of apparent in my references before, which is that civics education should be based on giving knowledge, about teaching knowledge, about teaching chronology and actual history and events, especially looking back to core documents and core significant individuals. It should be historically based, especially. It shouldn't be based on a current ideological debate and then looking backwards to basically teach people about the current ideological debate. That's the huge divide here. And so the current critics are largely wanting to talk about current political ideological issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that goes back and actually tries to teach history, they are critical of because they think it should be taught ideologically. And that really is the nub of the problem.
How should one balance promoting reverence for our founding fathers, in some ways astonishment at what was accomplished, while also acknowledging our shortcomings throughout history?
So this gets back to the real deep underlying problem of this more ideological approach, which is increasingly dominant in the teaching profession, which is if you look back and teach ideologically, first of all, that's bad history. It's backwards history. You're teaching history backwards. But more importantly, you have ideology has put blinders on you, so you can't actually see the history itself, which is you also can't see the good of the history. The best way to teach history is to teach it warts and all, as we like to say, to teach it and not ignoring the past, but to teach it honestly. So if you look at the American founding, for instance, which is the centerpiece of American civic education, slavery existed. Slavery is a barbaric practice. It's a stain on the founding. It's kind of the central stain. But what's amazing is that, you know, on the one hand, they didn't get rid of slavery in 1776. But what's amazing is that a bunch of people, many of whom owned slaves, declared that all men are created equal. That is, they put the principle down in the Declaration of Independence. And then American history is a playing out of those principles. As history actually occurs, it's individuals trying as best they can, sometimes failing, sometimes accomplishing great movements forward. living up to those principles. And that's how you teach history in a way that tells the real story based on the actual facts, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But it also allows you to realize that in doing so, they accomplished these great and amazing things in Western civilization that really is a culmination of long histories well before America that it led to the fact that you could establish a nation that begins with a principle that ultimately leads to the abolition of slavery.
We'll pause there and return in just a moment with Dr. Matthew Spaulding from Hillsdale in D.C. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This holiday season, join the all-new tradition of lights and festivities for the entire family at Redding Garden of Lights.
Taking place November 17th through January 7th at Turtle Bay's McConnell Botanical Gardens.
At the Sundial Bridge in Redding, California.
Explore over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens featuring over 1 million lights. Plus holiday-themed food, drinks, music, and so much more.
Redding Garden of Lights, presented by Mercy Medical Center, Redding.
Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Happy holidays from our Home Helpers family to yours. At Home Helpers, we are proud to help your loved ones celebrate this holiday season from the safety and comfort of their own homes. We are equally proud of the men and women who can't be with us. To the bravest among us, far from home serving our country this holiday season, to all members of the military in all branches, past and present, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice. With respect, gratitude, and love, we thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Home Helpers. Life takes you to unexpected places. Love brings you home.
The seasons are changing. Keeping your family healthy is important. So is the health of your car. The longevity and reliability of your vehicle depends on you to make sure your oil, radiator coolant, windshield wipers, and other vital systems have all been taken care of so your car can bring your healthy family through the seasons. Drive into Premier Oil Change today and experience the friendly oil change. Premier doesn't require an appointment, and you don't drop your car off or wait. Maintain your car warranty with our service while you stay in the comfort and safety of your own car. Enjoy a free beverage and Wi-Fi while our trained technicians perform our comprehensive 30-point service. Earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Stop into a Premier Oil Change near you today. Visit us in Palisadro, in the Holiday Shopping Center, or in Redding, on Lake Boulevard, near Waterworks Park, and Anderson, across from Roundtable Pizza. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier, your friendly oil change.
Hi, Bob the Drop here. The other day, I had a close encounter with my friends from Mars. I visited them a few years back, and they discovered the great taste of Mount Shasta spring water. Well, I guess they ran out, so they came back to Earth to get some more. I reminded them it comes from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta, and it's bottled at the source. I guess they just didn't get the part about us delivering right to your door. Have your own close encounter by calling 1-800-922-6227 to get some of the best tasting water in the galaxy. Pure and simple, naturally, the best Mount Shasta spring water.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51. In a Jefferson state of mind.
we're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. He's written a piece over at the Washington Examiner about what citizens should learn about America and about civics education. Dr. Spaulding,
when you talk about the ideological lens or the perspectives that begin to enter into civics education, if we go back, we look at primary documents. Is that a way to counteract or sort of get away from the ideological perspectives?
That's the primary way to do so. But the general concept here is, if you're teaching history, you're teaching the founding, let's say, or George Washington, you're teaching Abraham Lincoln or Frederick Douglass, you're teaching about events. Well, those events are done by individuals. And the obligation, your first obligation as a historian, is to come to understand it as they understood it. Right? I mean, they didn't have the knowledge we have today. They didn't have, mm-hmm. they don't know what happens next. They don't know what's going to happen. They're doing the best they can. They're flawed individuals. They're imperfect. But they're also, intelligent, rational, capable of thinking things through. So, how do you do that? Well, you try to kind of get into their minds to the extent you can as a historian. And a primary way to do it is to actually look at actual things they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Primary documents. That's why you emphasize that, because they wrote them at the time. And that tells you a lot. So a good history will be dominated by original documents, the key figures that had a lot to say did a lot of the key things and were involved in the events at the time. And it will maximize that, and it will minimize, if not completely get rid of, current thinkers looking back and postulating what may or may not have been the case, or worse, looking back through their ideological blinders and reinterpreting a narrative to lead to their ideological outcome, which is what you really see today when you think about the great distinctions between, say, a traditional curriculum like Hillsdale's and something like the 1619 Project,
uh-huh.
which really seeks to reinterpret American history, oftentimes getting many of the facts wrong, but it's not about the facts from their point of view, it's about the narrative. And the narrative is that America is a racist country inherently, and thus it needs to go in a different direction currently ideologically. It's not about history at all.
Uh-huh.
It's about politics in a very current sense. So I don't actually even consider that to be civics history at all.
What kind of a student should a proper civics education attempt to form, and what virtues should it attempt to cultivate in them?
That's a great question. One way to answer is, first of all, talk about what it's not intended to create. A good civic education, meaning a good civic education in the context of America, should seek to create a good citizen, and a good citizen is liberal, to which I don't mean conservative versus liberal or left mm-hmm. versus right. I mean it in the sense they're liberal as in liberal education. They're liberally minded. They understand human, what are the core principles here? Human equality, consent, equal rights, liberty, self-government, rule of law, constitutionalism. It doesn't mean they all agree on every particular. It doesn't mean they're of one political party or another. It doesn't mean they're of a particular religion or any of these things. But the reason you have civic education in the first place, its justification, is to form a citizen who will be able to self-govern,
uh-huh.
participate in the governing process, respect the rights of their fellow citizens, and actually defend those rights when they come under threat. Because that is the one thing that we need to agree on, despite our differences on policies and politics and left and right. The only way this will work is if we agree on a certain underlying framework.
Uh-huh.
Which is, what's the process by which we do disagree? Well, that requires what? The rule of law and the Constitution. It requires that we all participate and consent to how we're governed. And that in turn requires that we all understand we are equal before the eyes of the law. We have equal liberty. We have equal rights. No one matters more than anybody else. So it does form a certain type of person, and it does form a certain type of character. You respect the law. It moderates your passions in a way. It encourages your deliberation as opposed to your immediate reactions. But it's not intended to give immediate political opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Although, unfortunately, because of the debate we find ourselves in over civic education more broadly, right, that general thing I've just described, which is not left, right, or center, it's just, you know, a general concept of citizenship, that itself is oftentimes criticized, which is deeply unfortunate. Especially when you think about the kind of the future of how we continue to govern, self-govern ourselves.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding with us. A final question. Is it important or should it be a goal of a proper civics education and what citizens should learn about America to leave that education with a positive vision or a positive view of America?
Absolutely, but let's parse for just a moment what exactly that means.
Mm-hmm.
And when the critic says it, it means that we're trying to brainwash our children and our citizens to believe that America never made a mistake and it's perfect in every way, and it's you know, all its leaders are demigods. Well, okay, there's a limit to how far that goes. But there is kind of a sense of kind of informed, intelligent patriotism.
Uh-huh.
That is the objective here. And so what you want to do is you want to teach students to, especially as they grow up, from small children to, you know, high schoolers, and as they're maturing, right, you're teaching them that, yes, history is imperfect. The vessels of history, these individuals are themselves perfect. They often make mistakes, which is the human condition. And yet here's what they've accomplished. And I think laid out that way and looked at that way, one can see that as with other people around us today, right, there are flaws and imperfections and mistakes, but yet the larger accomplishment is of great magnitude. Especially when you think about it compared to the rest of the world and all of previous history. And, the answer is yes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, patriotism, which is love of country, but it doesn't mean blind love. It means informed and thoughtful love that sees things with clear eyes, but can see and see the flaws, but can also see the good. And so that is at the heart of a good civic education.
You can read Dr. Spaulding's essay at the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. It is What Should Citizens Learn About America? Dr. Matthew Spaulding is Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. Dr. Spaulding, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott.
Up next, Tim Carney from the Washington Examiner. We'll talk with him about babies and whether Americans should be having more. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading has the perfect gift this holiday season. Car wash packages starting at only $11. They make great stocking stuffers and are excellent gifts for those who are a little hard to shop for. Choose from four different car wash packages. Buy five car wash packages and get one free. Or buy 10 and get three free. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. Quick and clean.
Do you or someone you love struggle with PTSD, anxiety, depression, insomnia, OCD, alcoholism, substance abuse disorder, autism, ADHD, brain fog, or traumatic brain injury? At Shasta Meadows Wellness Center, Dr. Taggart and his team offer safe, proven, and effective care, even for those resistant to typical medicine. Learn more about Shasta Meadows Wellness Center. They have IV ketamine or at-home oral ketamine. Ask about the state-of-the-art EEG-guided TMS therapy. This customized, safe, no-side-effect option is effective on a wide range of difficult-to-treat conditions. Visit us today at ShastaMeadowsWellness.com. Don't just get by. Get well.
Call to make an appointment for a free consultation. 530-444-8304. 530-444-8304. Shasta Meadows Wellness Center in Reading.
Hey, what's going on in Reading, California? This is Tony Horde with Better Homes and Gardens Results Real Estate. Be sure and tune in to KCNR on your radio dial Wednesdays at 5 p.m. for Living in the North State. Together with my three amazing co-hosts, Rich Howe, Bill Woodford, and Mindy Cochran, we'll be interviewing professionals in the industry and taking your calls to answer all your questions and have a great time doing so. Talk to you then, Reading.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue, open and free, every other Sunday, right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. You can find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Tim Carney. He is columnist at the Washington Examiner, also a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI.org. You can find him on X, formerly Twitter, at TP Carney. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to talk to you today about babies.
Yes.
You know a little about that. How many do you have?
We have six kids.
Six.
The oldest of whom is currently visiting Hillsdale.
So. And with six children, you'd fit right in the Hillsdale community. There's no doubt about that. But birth rates, you've written a couple of times in the past and actually are working on a book right now that will be out in early, mid-2024. About this topic, the crisis of collapsing birth rates in the U.S., why should we treat it as a topic that deserves that word, crisis?
For a couple of reasons. One is while we are now having 1.6, 1.7 babies per woman, the average American in the recent poll said that 2.7 was the ideal family. So we're falling a whole baby short of what our ideal is. And I don't think everybody needs to get their ideal, right? Like my ideal house would have a wraparound porch. But but family is something that really matters. And so if we're all falling this far short in what our ideal is, that tells us something is wrong. But then having low and falling birth rates really poses economic and sociological problems. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for culture.
What are those consequences? Culture, economy, what are we losing by not reaching our target birth rate? Yeah.
So 2.1 is a replacement rate. A lot of people know that. So 1.6, eventually the population starts shrinking. But before that, right now we already have fewer children in America than we did 10 years ago. The baby bust started in 2008, and so the 2010s was a decade of millennials not pulling their weight. And so there are actually a few fewer children in America today than there were 10 years ago. What does that mean? That means that the potential workforce in a few years will start shrinking. So that is the number of people between the ages of 18 and 65 will start going down in the next couple of years and go down for the foreseeable future. So it's easy to think of Social Security not being able to pay its bills because there are fewer workers and more retirees. But that's only just, I think that's like an image of what's really happening. There will be retired people who need to buy stuff at a record high level, and there will be fewer workers providing those services or making those goods or delivering them than there were earlier. So as we have an increasing number of retirees and a decreasing number of workers, guess what? Have you liked the inflation and the supply chain disruption of the last few years? That's going to become a lot more acute when the baby bust hits the working age.
The ideal family size question that people are asked, you say the answer ends up being 2.7. We're nowhere near that. And in fact, if you look at the opposite, meaning who says zero, who says one is ideal, essentially nobody.
Almost
like
nobody.
9% total.
Every one of those people is a columnist for the Washington Post, right? You read these all the time. And so now Gen Z, I think if you ask high school seniors and college kids, they're much more likely to say that they don't think they ever want to have kids. Millennials, the story of millennials, though, is that they wanted to get married later, start having kids later, but still have 2.7. And they are, a lot of them are finding that that's just not in the cards. But the story of Gen Z might be a darker one. It could be that that number that says zero or one will grow. And I think that that is a result of the baby bust. So you guys know the word Malthusian. Thomas Malthus was an economist who argued that birth rates were like prices. As they fell, people got richer. And then when people were richer, they were able to have more kids, but that made them poor, that they were self-correcting, right? Now, the study I've done has shown that in the modern world, when birth rates fall below 2.1, they basically just keep going down. It's self-reinforcing.
So why aren't we reaching what people say is the ideal family size? You've written a few things about this. I wanted to ask about, if a culture is anti-baby, people won't have babies, and inside that, this idea of civilizational sadness, and it's different perhaps on where you look, overseas, overwork, but here in the U.S. there is this strange climate fear that overtakes people and makes them afraid to bring new people into the world. How much does that, you know, literally affect the way people see their children?
It's certainly the top reason given by young people who say they may not have children. Like, I don't know, but I might not. The top reason they give is worry about the climate. Now, I don't like to sort of psychoanalyze everybody, but Ezra Klein did a good made a good point that there will be no climate disaster in the United States. And Ezra Klein is a big believer that climate change is real and it's happening, but rich countries can adapt. So the fact that our young people say there's going to be a climate disaster, he says that's really a cover story for guilt, that white rich people have destroyed the planet. I think that's true, but I think that that guilt isn't just about climate. I think it's about a real belief that we're not good, that we're destroying the environment through pollution, through litter. That people always bring up litter when they say why they don't want to have kids. It's very interesting. That we're vectors for disease, that we're all irreparably racist, a lack of belief in basic human goodness. Why would you want to make more humans if you think humans are bad? I think that the climate is a cover story for guilt, and the guilt is rooted in a misanthropy and a false anthropology.
Talking with Tim Carney here about the crisis of collapsing birth rates, you have written that a culture, or our culture now, supports raising children less than it used to. In what ways do we see that?
No, and that's why I call the book Family Unfriendly, is that a culture needs to support kids. A wise woman put it well. It takes a village to raise a child. And it's hard to, sometimes you don't even realize how family unfriendly we are until you go to a place that's super family friendly. I mean, Hillsdale is a family friendly place. The professors here think it's normal to have four kids. And
actually, they think four is too few.
to have four kids within the first 6 years. Or Mormon Utah. Some of the book and the articles I've written are out of places like that, or BYU Idaho. And I went to Israel, which is very family friendly, very supportive of people having kids. One guy put it this way. He said, the bus drivers there have a real affection for little kids because a 6-year-old will ride the bus. Now, even the most, you know, urbane six-year-old is going to need some help. And the bus drivers will stop and, you know, park the bus and help the kid in and give him a seat. And so when you see a real family-friendly culture, or if you live in a family-friendly subculture, you see how the attitude in America is kind of that, well, having a kid is like a consumption choice. Have as many as you want, but don't bug us with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have public spaces that are built to be friendly. A lot of places, kids can't walk anymore. You and I, we used to probably ride our bikes and run all over the town, and suburbs are built less bikeable and less kid walkable than they used to. There's all sorts of ways in which we did think that some people are parents and that's their own problem, mm-hmm. rather than deliberately building a community to say getting married and having kids is what you do when you're an adult. Not everybody, but it's a natural thing.
What about policies that might encourage more births? He's written about South Korea, where they've spent more than $200 billion over the course of a decade to attempt to boost birth rates. Has that been at all successful?
Not in Korea. Japan has had some mild success, going from the worst in the world to about one. Hungary has had some mild success, and France has had some mild success. And so what we find is, if you give tons of money, no strings attached, to parents, you can slightly push up the birth rate. And I'll say, subsidizing daycare does absolutely nothing.
Hmm.
You have to just give it to the parents as a check when they have the baby, and every year, a massive child tax credit or child allowance. And it's a significant portion of the economy in France is subsidizing these things. And it pushes them up. The non-immigrant birth rate in France is 1.8, which is high. In the rest of Europe, it's 1.5. So the difference, France's extra spending gets them a third of a baby. So it's not tenable to do it. I support a slightly larger child tax credit. I think on the local level, again, sidewalks, bike lanes. Maybe I sound like a liberal talking about bike lanes, but your kids, you should be able to ignore your kids more when they're 10, 11, 12, 13, and the shape of your community really has something to do with that. Our tax credits that are currently for daycare should just get folded into a slightly bigger tax credit for parents. There's all sorts of subsidies and taxes that make buying a house really expensive, and they say, oh, well, you make it up on the end when you sell it. Well, barriers to entry for family formation are definitely family unfriendly.
Tim Carney, columnist with the Washington Examiner, also a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You find him on Twitter or X at TP Carney, and look for the book in 2024. The name of it is?
Family Unfriendly.
Family Unfriendly, as we talk about the crisis of the collapsing birth rate. Tim, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Dr. D.G. Hart from Hillsdale College as we start a brief series on American writer H.L. Mencken. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Christmas lights do more than glitter and glow. They represent a gift of love given a long time ago. This holiday season, join historic Hollis Farms on a magical journey through Lights on the Farm, presented by award-winning light designer at Redding Lights. Climb aboard the Haas Express Railways or travel by country-covered wagons through a spectacular interactive holiday light show where childhood memories and family traditions come alive. Enjoy a simple country Christmas with cocoa, candied apples, carolers, and a visit with Santa. And it's a very special gift from Greg and Nicola Hawes. Every Thursday night, children 12 and under are free, with special discount pricing for seniors and veterans every Sunday. It's the Hawes family way of saying thank you and Merry Christmas. Limited tickets are available, so hurry. Reserve your tickets today at historichawesfarms.com and make a memory. Start a new tradition with your family at Historic Hawes Farms, Lights on the Farm, where they've been celebrating the holidays for over 150 years.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel has a full-service organization with departments staffed with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Susan Eastman, financial advisor, Stifel Nicolaus. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Give me a call at 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Hi, this is Elle. Join me and my good friend and co-host Ron Lim for our new show, Ask Elle, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Every Tuesday night at 6 p.m., we will be exploring powerful topics on how to have a successful and satisfying relationship. See you here Tuesday nights at 6 p.m.
Brought to you by Kindness Revolution, Wendy Douglas Insurance.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family-owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can follow us on X, formerly Twitter, for show and guest information. We're at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined now by D.G. Hart. He is Associate Professor of History here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Hart, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me as well.
Starting a series with you on H.L. Mencken. You've written a book, Damning Words, The Life and Religious Times of H.L. Mencken. Generally are the Mencken person here on campus, so the right person to talk to. In this first conversation, we'll introduce Mencken a bit, and then I want to talk about his ideas and thoughts on professionalism and journalism. Right? So first, tell us a little bit of background on Mencken. Who was he? Why is he worth remembering and talking about today?
Mencken lived from 1880 to 1956, and he grew up relatively well off. His father was a cigar maker in Baltimore. He had great attachment to Baltimore, which may come up in our conversations. And his father, he only had a high school education. His father wanted him to inherit the business. Mencken wanted to be a journalist. His father forced him to take over the business when he graduated high school. And then all of a sudden his father dies, and Mencken is delighted and yet really grieved that he, you know, both those emotions are mixed up in that event. So then he always wanted to be a reporter, starts to work for one of the local newspapers in Baltimore, and he loved it. He talks about in some of his later writing about journalism that was the best 3 or 4 years of his life just being on the streets of Baltimore. He was covering everything. I mean, Kiwanis meetings, church meetings, murders or the police beat, et cetera. But he was a really active, ambitious guy. And he was writing on the side, and he wrote books on the side. He wrote literary criticism on the side. By the 1910s, he takes over editing a magazine called The Smart Set, which was partly literary criticism and I think fiction that he didn't approve of necessarily. And then he's still working for the Sun Papers in Baltimore, and he has a column that everyone begins to read very actively. This is before syndication, but some, I guess, papers are picking it up. And then he vaults into editing another magazine. He starts a magazine called the American Mercury, which he edits between 1923 and 1933. And in that venue, he was responsible for bringing a lot of authors that are sort of part of the canon either into life or publishing, people like Fitzgerald or and others. And he was this really odd figure of being a journalist and being a literary critic. And I you know, he kind of has elements that he might be like Ben Shapiro or something. And I talk to students about this, but I can't figure out who would be that Ben Shapiro type figure who would also do literary criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes into decline in popularity. He was very popular in the 20s. During the New Deal, he was very critical of the New Deal, and he lost some of his following. But he has a resurgence later in life, late 1930s, early 1940s. He starts to write articles for The New Yorker about his life growing up in Baltimore, which leads to his trilogy of memoirs, first Happy Days, second Newspaper Days, third Heathen Days, where he kind of documents his life or talks about different parts of his life.
Let's talk a little about his work in journalism with The Sun and elsewhere. What did he bring to the table that was different or unique? Why did he become so popular in the 20s?
He was a force and a promoter, in a way, of himself. I guess one way to explain it, too, is that he became involved, and this is true in the 20s, but even before this, Theodore Dreiser was a novelist with whom he had a love-hate relationship, and they both more or less depended on each other. Mencken was a champion of Dreiser, but that was in some ways for Mencken to promote himself, and Dreiser needed somebody to promote him, so he liked it, even though they had a falling out. And there were obscenity laws that kept Dreiser's books out of print for a time. And Mencken was a big champion of free speech and making sure that defending Dreiser in various ways. And I think notoriety that came to Mencken with that episode, for instance, was one reason why he was. But he was also writing in the 19-teens about American culture and American politics in ways that were unusual, at least, and very provocative. And he could say it very well. He was a great writer. He tried his hand at prose and poetry. I mean, fiction and poetry, and it didn't work, but he had his own style, which I think has literary aspects to it. So all those things kind of combined, being an editor, being a defender of someone like that, he began to get attention in the press. He was already in the press, but I think he was fairly restrained about writing about himself. So, there are stories in the 1920s when the American Mercury starts. That every college student in America wanted to be seen holding a copy of the American Mercury. It was this bright green cover. Even Perry Miller, who was a famous historian of Puritanism at Harvard, confessed to being that way when he was a student.
In 1924, he wrote a kind of reflection on the changing atmosphere of his line of work in journalism and the increasing, as he put it, professionalism of journalism. What did he mean by that phrase, and what did he think about that?
He didn't think it was good. What he meant by it was, and this may be his own, although I don't think he really resented not having gone to college. I think he was kind of proud of that, actually. But he did notice that more and more journalists were going to college, and this was becoming a profession for them. When he started, you had a bunch of probably hacks, he would call them. Some guys were dipsomaniacs. Some guys needed to have all of their copy rewritten. But you just had this swarm of reporters out on the streets covering different things, and they weren't necessarily trying to make a name for themselves. They didn't necessarily have an ideological perspective. And newspapers then were, it seems to me, also much more – I mean, they were a business. They're always a business. But the way that they made – their money then was advertising, and it was local advertising. It wasn't national advertising. So these were institutions, papers, publications that were bound up with the city. And so you had people, you know, who were products of the city, who kind of liked the city. Maybe they knew its faults. They could write about it in that way. But they're very local institutions. And I think he also saw that with the college and professional classes coming in, they weren't as local. They might be moving somewhere from somewhere else, so they didn't understand the city as well. But then they were also people with had to pay a mortgage. They had families, they had kids, and so they were not they were dependent on a salary, and they were unwilling, I think, to take risks in what they were covering, what they were writing, standing up to editors. So I think he thinks journalism may have become better in some respects, but it also lost some of what had made it at least really arresting by covering a lot of weird stuff in cities.
You wrote in your book about H.L. Mencken, Damning Words, that Mencken viewed literary criticism as a catalytic, meaning something that helps two other substances react, in this case, the author and his audience. Did Mencken think that press criticism also could serve that same positive purpose?
Probably I would say yes, although I don't know that he wrote about that in the same way. And I would say yes in the sense that his columns, I mean, he wound up, initially having a what we would almost call today a blog post. He would I forget the name of it. Freelance, maybe. I think was what it was called. And he would have a running digest of things that struck him in the news or different. So there was modest amount of editorializing, some just kind of reflecting out loud, some noting different events going on in the city or some figure who's visiting town. And eventually, though, he does have a syndicated column where he becomes more outspoken and people – that's another part of his growing fame where people want to read Mencken even if they don't like it. It's one of those, you know, push and pull things. And in that sense, I think he saw that op-eds at least could be that kind of catalytic in sparring between an audience and the sorts of things that newspapers were covering.
D.G. Hart is Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. His book on H.L. Mencken is Damning Words, The Life and Religious Times of H.L. Mencken. Dr. Hart, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Good to be with you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Matthew Spaulding, Tim Carney, and D.G. Hart. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. The assistant producer of the program is Sam Lair. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's never too late to start at Shasta College. Late start classes and 8-week compressed classes are still available. To learn more about upskilling or reskilling for a current job or career, information is online at shastacollege.edu or call one of our counselors to see how easy it is to get enrolled at 530-242-7650. Shasta College offers in-person, hybrid, and online class options to fit your busy life and responsibilities. Financial aid is available. More at shastacollege.edu.
This is Ted Lighty with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Lighty, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Hey there, friends. RC here with Tobacco and Brew. This month, we're bringing you an exclusive and new cigar, the 1502 XO. I'll be very deliberate with this one, folks. This is the smoothest cigar I've smoked ever. The 1502 XO. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Here at KCNR Radio, we are fortunate to have two well-informed citizens. Hi, I'm Nick Gardner.
And I'm Doug Janke, and we'll give you the inside scoop of news affecting you.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest, Sundays, here, 8 o'clock.
KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and on your AM dial, 1460.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Redding has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.